So I think the topic for today was something to the effect of how can Buddha Dharma help you in your life? Especially in this modern age. And I think that these teachings that Shakyamuni Buddha gave 2,500 years ago are just as applicable now as they were at the time of the Buddha. The cultural examples may have changed, but the teachings about how the mind works are the same, because we basically have the same mind then as now. So I think one of the things that is most valuable about the Buddha Dharma in today's age is that it really provides a vision of life that gives us some hope and some faith and some optimism about the future. Because one thing that is different than at the time of the Buddha is that people are exposed to much more information nowadays, and we know what's going on the other side of the world. And the media also exploits our fear and anxiety in terms of what it reports. It wants to make us fearful and anxious, because somehow when we get revved up like that, we buy more things. Yeah. I find it quite interesting in the media when you try and get things published. For example, a number of years ago we had this conference of Western Buddhist monks. I couldn't get any Buddhist magazines to publish anything about it. You know, they weren't interested in a group of women doing something virtuous. If I had called it, you know, Buddhist Nuns Tell All, I'm sure they would have all bought it up. And, you know, it would have been a top seller. You know, but so somehow, you know, we're exposed to a lot of this kind of negativity. And the media doesn't report much about what's going well and about human kindness and things that people have accomplished in a positive way. And so as a result, I think nowadays people have more anxiety and depression and despair because they don't have a positive vision of the future. So, you know, people then have these same mental qualities, but maybe they didn't come out as much because the social system wasn't quite as complicated. They didn't have IRAs and 401ks and stock markets, you know, back at the time of the Buddha. So you didn't have to worry about all those things going bankrupt. Although you did have to worry about all your crops failing. You know, and there was no social security system then, although we don't know if there's going to be much left in our country either. Anyway, I think that this whole thing about how to have an optimistic mind is something very important for people today, because without it, there's no joy in life. And without it, we dig ourselves into an emotional hole of depression and despair, which we don't need to dig ourselves into, because I think there is a lot of reason for optimism. It's just that we aren't used to thinking about it. But I think the Buddha Dharma shows us how to turn our mind around so we can see the goodness in the world. It does this, I think, in several ways. Two of the principal ones are the teachings on refuge and the teachings on bodhicitta, or the altruistic intention of love and compassion. And I think these two things help us adjust in the world and have a happy life. Someone wrote a book once and really talked about refuge in terms of how to be peaceful when being alone in our own heart, and bodhicitta about how to be peaceful when being together with others. Okay, so there's two situations that we're usually in, either we're alone or with others. So how to have an open and kind heart in both those situations. Okay, so when we talk about refuge, I'll talk about that one first and then bodhicitta second. Refuge, you know, how is it something that gives us peace of mind when we're alone? Because refuge helps us develop a positive outlook of life and a feeling of connection to all the holy beings. So we may be alone in the sense that there aren't other human beings in the room, but we're not alone in our heart because we have deep refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, so being alone is very different from being lonely. We can be alone, you know, be the only one in our house, but feel quite connected to the holy beings or even to other human beings. And so we may be alone, but not lonely in that way. Okay, so refuge gives us that connection specifically with the holy beings. When they talk about refuge, there's usually two principal causes for taking refuge. And refuge means turning to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for spiritual guidance. So, you know, really clarifying in our mind what the spiritual direction we're taking in our life. So the two principal causes, and then in Mahayana they talk about three principal causes. The first one is the sense of caution. The second one is a sense of faith or confidence or trust. And then the third one is compassion. Okay? So the stronger these three causes are, the deeper our refuge and our connection with the three jewels. And thus, the more optimistic mental state we're going to have because of the connection with them. Okay, so when we talk about the sense of caution that will motivate us to take refuge, here we look at the fact that our life is not under our control 100%, and that we are under the control of our afflictive emotions, of our karma, and that because of that, we want to be cautious about what we say and do and what we think and feel, because all these mental, verbal, physical actions create karma, and if we're not cautious, if we're not careful, we could create the karma, the actions that bring forth an unfortunate rebirth or bring forth suffering. Okay? So it's an awareness of the situation that we're living in and a sense of caution that brings, that we don't want to just follow any old thought that comes into our mind. We want to have some discriminating wisdom about what thoughts and emotions we follow and what thoughts and emotions we believe in and what thoughts and emotions we let guide our life. Okay, so there's that sense of caution because we realize that, you know, these thoughts and emotions and actions, you know, create the cause for what we're going to experience. Okay, so that's the sense of caution that we want to have. Then the second main factor for taking refuge is a sense of faith and confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to be able to guide us from the possible sufferings that we may experience if we're not cautious. Okay? So to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we need to know a little bit about what they are. Okay? The Dharma is the real refuge. Okay, the Dharma refers to the last two of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so to the true cessations of sufferings and their causes, and to the true paths that lead to those cessations. So the Dharma refuge is what we develop in our own hearts, in our own minds. And the more we have actualized the Dharma in our minds, the more that is the protection from suffering already. Okay? So when we say the Dharma is the real refuge, it doesn't mean just believing in the Dharma, it means practicing and actualizing it and transforming our own mind and heart into the Dharma. Okay, into the path to enlightenment, thereby actualizing the stopping of the afflicted mental states, the stopping of the karma that creates rebirth, the stopping of suffering. Okay, so those stoppings or cessations, yeah, that's the real joy that we can actualize. Okay, so the Dharma refuge is the real one that we actualize in our mind. When, as we're actualizing that, we become the Sangha, those beings who have realized emptiness. And then as we actualize the Dharma more and more, we become a Buddha, somebody who has completely realized the Dharma. Okay? So that Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that we will become, that's the real refuge, and that's often called the inner refuge. It's inner because it's inside our own mind. Now, to generate that inner refuge, our own realizations, you know, the inner refuge of ourselves becoming the Sangha and the Buddha, to do that, we have to rely on the external objects of refuge. So these are the Buddhas, Dharma, and Sangha that are external to us. Okay? So in this case, the Dharma refers to the teachings, and they are symbolized by the scriptures. The Sangha refers to all the beings who have actualized the realization of emptiness, who have seen the nature of reality completely clean, clear through direct perception. That's the real meaning of Sangha. And then the Buddha is the one who has purified his mind completely and thus teaches the Dharma, is a founding Buddha and teaches the Dharma in our world. Okay? So these are the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that are external to us, the other living beings who have actualized the Dharma in their mind. Okay? So to actualize our internal refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that we're going to become, we need to, at the beginning, rely on the external refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that already exist in the universe. Okay? So that what that boils down to is we need spiritual guidance. Okay? We cannot make up the path to enlightenment on our own because we've been in cyclic existence since beginningless time. So we've had plenty of time to make up our own path. And we've probably done it lots and lots of times. But it hasn't liberated us because we're still here. So this is, you know, a lifetime where we have some fortune to actually meet the Buddha's teachings, you know, and meet the Dharma and Sangha. And so instead of making up our own path to enlightenment and falling flat on our face, now we can actually rely on some reliable guides. Okay? The Buddha is reliable because he's completely purified all of his negative qualities, his or her, because there can be female manifestations and male manifestations of the Buddha. Okay, so someone who's completely abandoned all defilements in their mind stream and developed all their good qualities to full fruition. Okay, so sometimes we hear that, it seems a little bit abstract, but think about it, okay? If you're a Buddha, it means you never get angry again. Can you imagine that? Somebody who never gets angry, no matter how many people insult them or call them names or destroy their homes or, you know. I mean, that's quite an incredible quality, isn't it, to never get angry. Okay. A Buddha is somebody who not only doesn't get angry, but has love and compassion for the person that harms them. Right. So, you know, when we think about these kinds of qualities and compare them to our own self, then we really see that, it, you know, Buddhahood is quite an amazing state. You know, there's no jealousy in the Buddhist mind, no competitiveness, no laziness, no resentment, no anxiety and depression. But rather, a Buddha is somebody who's fully optimistic because they see that suffering comes from causes and those causes can be eliminated. And the Buddha has eliminated those causes by knowing the nature of reality. Okay? So we can see, you know, the state of Buddhahood is like a further development of where we're at. You know, we have the Buddha nature, Buddha potential right now. We have the seeds of the good qualities inside of us, but we need to develop these, and we need to apply the counter forces to our own ignorance, anger, and attachment. But when we do that, we too can become a Buddha. Okay? So we rely on the Buddha, the external Buddha, to teach us and to guide us. And a Buddha, you know, because they've eliminated all observations from their mind streams, they, from their own side, they don't have any interference in being of benefit to us or to anybody else. So a Buddha effortlessly and spontaneously appears whenever there's the opportunity to help a sentient being. When you think about our compassion, you know, we have to like really generate some effort, don't we? You know, and then sometimes it's like, okay, somebody needs some help, but oh, I'm so tired today. I really don't feel like it. So we have some interferences to acting out our compassion. And we can't manifest bodies spontaneously in order to be a benefit. Whereas a Buddha can manifest many different forms, many different bodies, without even trying, when there's the opportunity to benefit others. Okay. Now, of course, sentient beings have to create that opportunity to be benefited, because if we don't create the receptivity, a Buddha may be trying to benefit us but not be able to. Okay. So there the analogy is given like a bowl that's turned upside down. The sun might be shining very brightly, and the sunlight goes everywhere spontaneously and without hindrance from the side of the sun rays, but it can't go inside the bowl because the bowl has turned itself upside down. Okay, so when our mind is full of garbage, Lama Yeshe used to call, you know, ignorance, anger, and attachment, garbage mind. Okay, when our mind is sitting there just ruminating about me, 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 you know, it's like the bowl being turned upside down. Even the Buddha sitting in front of us, we're going to watch television instead of pay attention to the Buddha. Okay? So we have to do some purification and to create some merit or positive potential so that we can be like a bowl that's turned right side up and create the causes so that a Buddha can manifest in our lives and be a benefit to us. Now, of course, when the Buddhas manifest in our life, they don't come knocking on the door and say, hello, I'm the Buddha, I'm here to benefit you. Okay? The Buddha is much more subtle than that. So we don't really know who's a Buddha and who isn't, and, you know, how the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas actually work to benefit us, because they don't announce it, you know, they don't wear a name tag, hi, you know, I'm Kuan Yin and I'm here to help you. Okay. You know, it's more up to us. If we're aware and astute, you know, we receive help from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Okay. So the Buddha has the ability to benefit us from his or her own side because they've purified the mind and developed all the good qualities. The sangha that we take refuge in are those beings who have understood directly the empty nature of phenomena. That doesn't mean the non-existence of phenomena. It means the emptiness of fantasized ways of existence of phenomena. Okay? So somebody who has that high realization is also a reliable guide because they understand reality. Okay? They aren't going to be under the influence of their own ego, self-centered mind, but they're really going to be able to show us the path. So the sangha is a reliable guide. And of course, the Dharma being the path and the teachings, they're reliable because they are what the Buddha and the Sangha have followed and actualized in their own mind that have brought them to their own joyful levels of realization. Okay? So that's a little bit about the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. When you read the sutras or you read the commentaries, they explain in much more depth the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And it's really inspiring to read it because it gives us a whole different vision about what we can become and about what human beings are. Okay? So, you know, if I just compare it to the 6 o'clock news, you know, what do we see as the vision of human beings? You know, Saddam Hussein, George Bush, fashion models, athletes, movie stars. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be like any of those people. Okay? I don't find any of them very inspiring. Yeah. But when we think about the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which the 6 o'clock news does not report, but which is actually, you know, more important, then we have a sense of hope and vision about what we can become, and we have good role models to follow. Okay? And so, in the process of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the analogy is often given of somebody who's sick, going to a doctor and getting medicine, and then having, you know, the nurses help them. And I think this is actually quite a nice analogy that shows us what taking refuge in the three jewels means. So we're like the patient, okay? We're sick in a spiritual sense, you know? What do we suffer from? We suffer from not getting what we want, from getting what we don't want, from getting what we want and then being disappointed in it, okay? We suffer from being born and then getting old and getting sick and dying. We suffer from not having control over everything in our lives. We suffer from separation from the people and things that we care about. We suffer from anxiety and despair and fear, okay? So we're like the patient. So what does a patient do when they don't feel well? They go to the doctor. Yeah? So the doctor is the Buddha. Yeah? What does a doctor do? A doctor diagnoses the illness and then prescribes the medicine. So the Buddha looks at our suffering state and diagnoses its causes. You know, what causes the state of cyclic existence that we're caught in? Ignorance, clinging, attachment, and hostility. Those are the causes. And then a doctor, knowing what the causes are, prescribes the medicine. What's the medicine? The three higher trainings. The higher training in ethical discipline, higher training in concentration, higher training in wisdom, and then also the meditations to develop love and compassion and bodhicitta. That's the medicine that the Buddha prescribes to us. Okay? We fill the prescription. We take the medicine home. Okay? Now, we get home, and in an ordinary sense, sometimes we forget how to take the medicine, don't we? You know, doctor gave us a whole bunch of bottles, and we forget, is it one green pill in the morning and two red pills in the afternoon and three blue ones at night? Or is it one blue one in the morning and then two yellow ones at noon and, you know, three green ones at night? I mean, we forget. So the Sangha they're like the nurses, and they're the ones who remind us, yeah, how to take the medicine. And they encourage us. Because sometimes, you know, the doctor gave us these medicine, and, you know, they're these big kind of things, and they don't taste very good. So we go, ooh, I don't want to take it. You know, even though it's going to make me better, I don't want to take it. So the Sangha is the one that, you know, mashes it up and mixes it with applesauce, you know, and then takes a spoon and goes, open wide, ooh, and helps us take it, Okay? So the Sangha, they're like the nurses, you know. They encourage us, they inspire us, they set a good example, they help us to practice the Dharma. Okay? And so, in that way, the patient gets cured. Yeah? Because the patient goes to the doctor, gets the medicine, and practices according to the, you know, what the nurses or the Sangha, you know, encourage them to do. Now, the thing is, what we sometimes do is we don't go to the doctor when we're sick. Okay, so if we don't go to the doctor, it's like not turning to the Buddha for refuge. If you don't go to the doctor, you don't get an accurate diagnosis and you don't get any medicine. So if we don't go to the Buddha for refuge, we're not going to understand what causes our misery, and we're not going to get the medicine, the Dharma antidotes, for training our mind that will help us cut those causes. Sometimes we go to the doctor, we get the prescription, we bring the medicine home, we line it up in our room, but we don't take it. We look at the bottles. Yeah. We read the labels on the bottles. But we don't take the medicine and put it into our mouths. Okay? If we don't take the medicine, we don't get well. So, you know, that is analogous to, we might go to Dharma teachings, okay, Buddha gives us the teachings, we go to Dharma teachings, but then we don't practice. Yeah. The Dharma goes in one ear and out the other. And sometimes it doesn't even make it in one ear because we're too distracted. Okay? So having a distracted mind when you're listening to teachings, or forgetting the teachings afterwards, or not putting them into practice, or writing them down or getting the tapes but then not reviewing them so you don't know what to practice, that's like not taking the medicine. Yeah. So that's why it's really important that we not only receive the teachings, but we try and remember them and we try and put them into practice. Now, it's much easier to practice when we're with other people. And that's the purpose for having a Dharma center or a monastery or an abbey or a temple, is that it's a place where people go and practice together. And it becomes much easier to practice when there's other people, because you know, that your friends are there at the center. And if you go, you know you're going to get some practice done. We often say, oh, I don't want to drive to the center. It's too far. I'll practice at home. Do you really practice at home? Well, no, the phone rings. Okay? Or all of a sudden you remember you have to write some email. It's tremendously important. It's been there for 3 weeks, but now, today, this moment, you have to answer. You know? Or the TV program comes on that we've always wanted to see, and that's definitely more important than our meditation. Okay, so we so easily get distracted. Yeah. But when we really have a commitment to come together with other people in practice, then we know that our Dharma friends are there and they're waiting for us. You know? And we know that their energy inspires us, and we give our energy to them. Our energy inspires them. And so in that way, we get ourselves to the Dharma Center. Okay? And that's important. You know? So many people nowadays, I mean, they have so many excuses why they can't go to a teaching, why they can't go on a retreat. You know, I've always thought, writing a book, you know, 5,949,401 excuses why I can't practice the Dharma. Okay? And it's all just excuses. Yeah, it's all just our lazy mind. Because when we really see the value of the practice, then that's our number one priority. And everything else comes secondary. And if Dharma is our number one priority, practice becomes very easy. Okay? Why do you think people are workaholics? Because money is their number one priority. So then they find it easy to become workaholics. Now, I'm not advocating you become a dharmaaholic, okay? Anyway, there's no such thing. But what I'm getting at is when the Dharma is a priority in our life, practice becomes easy and we take the medicine easily. When we practice together in a group, we also create much more merit or positive potential than we create when we practice alone. Okay? It's like, if you have one little fiber of something and you try and sweep the floor, it's going to take a long time to sweep the floor. If you have a broom, which is a collection of many fibers, it's easy to sweep the floor, isn't it? Okay, similarly, when we try and practice alone, we have one little fiber trying to clean our mind. When we practice together with other people, the amount of positive energy, positive potential that we create is much greater. It's like a broom trying to sweep the floor. Okay? So that's why I really encourage people, when you have here at Mahabodhi Society practice evenings or teachings or retreats, come and practice with your Dharma friends. Okay? Or if you want to come, like when I'm teaching in Washington State or at the Abbey or somewhere else, then please come. You make it, you might have to get a plane ticket and make some effort, but when you go on vacation, you get a plane ticket and make some effort. So it's not like it's asking too much. Yeah. But what I'm getting at is, when we have the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in our life, we should really take advantage of that and not be lazy, not be apathetic, because we're not going to live forever, and we don't know if we're going to have such a great fortune again in future lives. No. And at the time we die, what's going to be a benefit to us is our connection with the three jewels. All the money in the world can't help us when we die. It's totally useless at the moment of death. Whereas the depth of our refuge, and the positive potential and merit we've created, that makes dying something quite easy, even something that can be fun. Yeah. And think about that, death being fun. You're not afraid, you don't have any regrets. So I've seen people die like that. Some of my teachers have died in that way. So it gives us an example of how we can practice what we can attain. Okay, so when we know something about the three jewels of refuge, then we can increase our faith and confidence and trust with them, in them. And that's the second cause of taking refuge. Now, sometimes they talk about three different kinds of faith or confidence or trust in the three jewels. And I think this is helpful to talk about because the word faith is often used, but it's not a very good English word to describe what the Buddhist word is. Okay, what the word in Pali or Sanskrit or Tibetan or Chinese is. It's often translated as faith. The English word is not a very good translation for that word. Because when we think of faith in America, we usually think of blind faith, don't we? And especially with kind of the revival of fundamentalism and evangelical, traditions that emphasize you just believe and you don't ask questions. And anyway, even if you ask the questions, you're not going to get answers because it's beyond our range of comprehension. So you're just supposed to believe because somebody said so or because it's written in a book or something like that. Well, from a Buddhist viewpoint, that kind of faith doesn't really make a spiritual practice very solid. Yeah, that faith is often motivated by fear, paranoia, or lack of understanding, or peer group pressure. Okay? And it's not a very stable basis for spiritual practice. Whereas in Buddhism, when we say the word faith, it doesn't mean that kind of blind, unquestioning faith.
it means a kind of confidence or trust that is based on understanding. Okay? So there's different levels of understanding. At the beginning, we hear about the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and we admire those qualities. That's called admiring faith, okay, or admirational faith. That's the first kind of faith. We hear about what an enlightened being is, you know, what the Dharma is, what the Sangha is, and we admire those qualities. And that gives some joy in our own mind, just knowing that there's people like that in this universe. Okay, so that's the first level of faith. We admire their qualities. As we learn more, we begin to understand that we can actualize those qualities, that we have the Buddha potential in our own heart, and it's possible for us to not just admire those qualities, but to develop those qualities in our own heart. And that becomes aspiring faith. That's the second kind of faith or confidence, where we really aspire to become the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, because we have some sense, some feeling that we can. And again, that gives us, you know, an incredibly positive view about, you know, our own life and our own potential. The third kind of faith is called convictional faith, okay, or confidence with conviction. And this comes from really studying the teachings and thinking about them deeply. And through thinking about them and seeing their validity because we've actually thought about them and tried them out, on that basis, we have confidence and trust. So that's a very deep kind of confidence and trust that can't be shaken, okay? Because it's based on learning the teachings and thinking about them and really understanding them. So the Buddha, all along, he stressed that his teachings are things to be understood and experienced, not just believed in and worshipped. Okay? And it's very, very clear, you know, when we read, especially the Pali Canon, the earliest sutras, you know, the Buddha compares his path to the teachings and paths described by other spiritual leaders of his age. And many of those spiritual leaders used rhetoric and some kind of quote-quote logic to explain their paths, but, you know, nobody had ever really realized it, okay? Or some people just taught something that was written in the holy book and said, it's written in the holy book, believe it, okay? Or some people taught a path that has just been in the tradition of their family for many, many generations. They don't even know where it began, but because it's been in their family tradition, they taught that path and said, okay, believe this and practice this. But the Buddha said, no, you know, my practice isn't based on some kind of rhetoric or some kind of tradition or some kind of, you know, old scripture. It's based on actual experience. You know, and he said it was his living experience and it can be our living experience too. Okay, so he really differentiated the path of the Dharma he taught from other things that were present at that time. And I think the same differentiations can be made between Buddha Dharma nowadays and other spiritual paths that are available to us. Okay? This is a very important distinction to make. And the Buddha really emphasized in the Kalama Sutra, you know, the Kalamas were a group of people, when the Buddha went to their land, they said, you know, we're so confused because all these people come and they teach all these things and we don't know what to practice. And so the Buddha said, no, you know, you don't do it just because someone said so. Because of an authority figure, or because of tradition, or because of scripture, or because of rhetoric. You try it out yourself and you experience through your own understanding and experience. Now, sometimes what has happened in Buddhist communities over the years is people have forgotten about this, and they have subsided into being content with simply worshipping the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay? So you will find Buddhist temples and communities where people don't listen to the teachings, where they just do prayers, okay, or they just do chanting. And it's very good to do prayers and chanting, but that's not sufficient, because we really need to have teachings, and we need to think about the teachings, and we need to practice the teachings in meditation and practice the teachings in our daily life. Just, you know, making offerings to the Buddha Dharma Sangha, just singing praises to the Buddha Dharma Sangha. These are not sufficient for gaining realizations, okay? They're good practices for accumulating merit, but just doing those alone aren't going to bring us the transformation in our heart and mind that we're really longing for. And so I find, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is consistently and continuously stressing the importance of listening to teachings and the importance of doing what we call analytic meditation, the meditation where we think about the different teachings point by point. And it's for that reason that I made the collection of Lam Rim CDs. Some of you may have these. It's a set of guided analytic meditations that lead you in how to think about the teachings. Okay? So this kind of practice is very important. It requires a little bit more energy on our own part because we have to think. We can't just sit there and visualize the Buddha and make prayers. Okay? Because it's easier to just think of the Buddha and say, Buddha, please make me compassionate. Okay? Now, of course, the Buddha has so much compassion that if the Buddha could, by his own force, transform our mind into compassion, the Buddha would have done it already. Okay? But the Buddha can't transform our mind. We have to transform our own mind. Okay? Practicing Dharma is like eating and sleeping. You have to do it yourself. Okay? If I'm exhausted, I can't say, look, I'm really busy, can you sleep for me? Okay? Or I'm really hungry and I don't have any time to eat, can you eat for me? It doesn't work, does it? Well, practicing the teachings are similar. We have to do it ourselves. We can't just make offerings and request somebody else to do a puja. Okay? I mean, it's nice to make offerings and it creates merit, but that's not going to be the thing that actually changes our mind. Okay? So we have to really put the effort in. Many of you have kids. You know that if all your kids did was just pray, you know, may I pass my SAT? You know? Is that going to give your child the ability to pass, you know, to get into college? No, you don't tell your children just pray to pass their exams. You tell them, look, you sit down and you open the book and you study and you put in energy. And you remember what your teacher taught you. And you remember what's in the book and you think about it and you try and understand. Okay, that's what you teach your kids. And that's even in secular studies. So when it comes, of course, to, you know, a spiritual path, which is much more difficult than secular studies, you know, of course, we can't just sit there and pray, may I become a Buddha. You know, may my suffering end. Yeah, may I win the lottery. May my son marry a nice girl and my daughter marry a nice boy. You know, that's not what it's about. You have to really practice. So don't be fooled if you, you know, go to places where people are just doing a lot of chanting and stuff like that, because they may not understand this. Okay? And also because there's people with different levels of aptitude. Yeah? So for some people, it's better that they do chanting and so on than that they don't do anything at all. Okay? And I think doing chanting and pujas and this kind of stuff is very good. We should do them. But what I'm saying is it's not sufficient. Okay, We really have to learn and we have to practice. And then when you do, that's when you're taking the medicine and you really get a taste. Yeah. And when you start to get a taste of the Dharma, it's so delicious that you want to go back for more. Okay? And then practice becomes much more easy. Okay, so this is also the purpose of going on retreats. You know, when you go on retreat, it's not just coming to a teaching one, you know, on Sunday morning, or it's not just doing a weekend thing, but it's doing maybe 10 days of really dedicated practice. Yeah? Or we just had a 3-month retreat at the Abbey, 3 months of dedicated practice. And so when you do this, you know, it's like, it's delicious, you know, because you really get a taste of the Dharma in your own life and understand yourself so much better. Okay? So that's a little bit about faith or confidence, trust, you know, that we develop in the three jewels. And when we have that in our mind, there's this sense of really deep connection with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, and it's not just an intellectual connection, it's really something that's in your heart. And when you have that in your heart, it's like having your best friend with you all the time. Because anywhere you are, anything that's going on, your best friend is there in your heart, and you can turn your attention to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and receive that understanding and that nourishment that you need. Okay? And so, since we never know what's going to happen in any particular day, yeah, having that availability of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha there to take refuge in our own heart is really important. Okay? Because sometimes things happen to us completely like that, unsurprised, and we're going, what do I do? Well, if we have that strong connection with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we just do a quick 911. Okay, 911 to the Buddha. Help! And then, you know, you figure out what Dharma practice, you know, you're supposed to think about at that time that changes your mind and helps you to deal with the situation. Okay, so it becomes very, very useful, you know, very helpful. And you never feel alone, even though you might be alone. You don't feel lonely, okay? Because there's always that connection. And especially at the time we die, if we can take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, then it prevents any kind of negative karma from ripening and guarantees that we're going to have a positive karma ripen, which will, you know, ripen in our having a good future rebirth. Okay, so taking refuge at the time of death is very, very important. You know, and if you want to help yourself and help the people you care about, you know, at the time of death, then you know, at least the people who are Buddhist anyway or have that meaning and tendency, remind them of the three jewels, remind them of their spiritual teacher, because then they can take refuge and feel that connection and die very peacefully. Okay, turn off the television. Don't let somebody die in a hospital with the television on. Okay? Yeah? I mean, I'm just totally horrified now at sometimes the situations people are in. Okay, so that's a little bit about refuge. I talked about two of the qualities, you know, a sense of caution and then faith or confidence or trust. The third cause for refuge in Mahayana refuge is compassion. And this links into the other part that I was going to talk to you about, that I started out at the beginning of the talk, in terms of what Buddhism can provide to people nowadays, and that's the techniques for developing love, compassion, and altruism. And that helps us to connect with other sentient beings. Refuge is the connection with the holy beings. Bodhicitta is the connection with sentient beings. But you can see that compassion for sentient beings can also be a cause for us taking refuge. So these things are not separate and unrelated, but they're very much related. Okay, so when we talk about bodhicitta, we're talking about having the aspiration in our heart to become a fully enlightened Buddha in order to most effectively benefit sentient beings. Okay? So this is the most noble intention, most noble motivation we can possibly have in our life. Okay? Why? Because it's something that's very extensive. You know, it's caring about the happiness of each and every living being. I mean, isn't that incredible to think that we can open our hearts to really include everybody? And it's not just having compassion and love, wanting others and ourselves to be free of suffering and to have happiness, but it's actually the aspiration to become a Buddha, in other words, to eliminate all our own obstructions to really being of the greatest benefit. And knowing that there's a path to eliminate all these obstructions so that we can become a Buddha, so that we can make our lives the most meaningful that we possibly can in terms of having the qualities of a fully enlightened Buddha that will enable us to benefit everybody most effectively. Okay? So, to develop this bodhicitta mind, we need two things. One is we need this altruistic intention to benefit sentient beings. And the second, we need to understand that it's possible for us to become Buddhas and that the method exists for us to become Buddhas. Okay? Now, to develop this altruistic intention, yeah, then there's a whole series in the teachings on how to develop bodhicitta, how to develop love and compassion. Actually, I think you have that whole series of teachings on CD. Yeah? So maybe we can all listen to them together because I don't have time to explain it. That series was a series of talks I gave over some time, so it's more elaborate. But it's basically opening our eyes to see that others want to be happy as much as we do and want to be free of suffering as much as we do. And furthermore, that they've all been kind to us. And so when we can really see this in a deep way, we see sentient beings as lovable. And that seeing them as lovable doesn't depend on how they act towards us. Okay? It simply depends on seeing them as kind and seeing them as wanting to be happy and be free of suffering. Okay? So this frees our mind from attachment to friends, aversion to enemies, and apathy to strangers. Okay? And it enables us to really have a sense of care and concern for everybody in an equal way, because we see that the categories of friend, enemy, and stranger change all the time. They're not fixed categories. Okay, when we were born, everybody was a stranger. Okay, then some people became friends, some became enemies. Then some of the friends became enemies, some of the enemies became friends. Okay, some of the enemies became strangers, some of the strangers became friends, some of the strangers became enemies, some of the friends became strangers. These relationships are always changing. Okay, so we're looking beyond those changeable, superficial relationships we have into something deeper, you know, and that everybody's exactly like us, wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, and everybody has in one way or another been kind to us and contributed to our welfare. On the basis of this, we see others as lovable and we can wish them happiness. Wishing sentient beings, and that includes ourselves, to be happy, that's the definition of love. Okay? Wishing sentient beings, and that includes ourselves, to be free of suffering, that's the definition of compassion. Okay? Based on love and compassion, we then think, we generate what's called the great resolve, which means I have to get involved and do something. I can't just sit here and pray again, you know. Buddha, everybody's suffering, please, you cure their suffering. Meanwhile, I'm going to lie down and have a nap. Okay? No, we've got to, you know, engage. So we have the great resolve Okay. And that gives rise to the aspiration to become a fully enlightened Buddha, because we see that as a Buddha we'll have the best opportunity to be the greatest benefit. Okay. Now, to actualize that bodhicitta, we've also got to see that it's possible for us to become Buddhists. Okay. So we have to understand that the nature of our mind is something clear and undefiled, and that the ignorance, anger, attachment, karma are like clouds that obscure it, but they aren't the nature of the mind. And so they can be purified because they're based on misconception. And then we need to understand how to eliminate those misconceptions, and we do that through developing the wisdom that understands reality, the wisdom that understands that things lack inherent existence. They don't have their own inherent essence, even though they do exist on a conventional level. Okay. So when we've developed all of those realizations, you know, then we can really actualize that bodhicitta intention and become fully enlightened Buddhas ourselves, which means that then we have become the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which is the internal refuge. Okay, so do you see how these things kind of all link together?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? I mean, I went through this last part very quickly because I want to leave some time for questions. But, you know, if you go back and maybe listen to it and think about how all these different facets of the Dharma link together, it will really help your understanding of that. Okay, so I basically spoke about refuge today and about somewhat about bodhicitta and how bodhicitta relates to refuge and so on, and really showing how refuge is a way to be alone with the holy beings, and bodhicitta is a way to feel connected to other living beings because we really open our hearts to them. Okay?